is a real privilege to come and have a part in this meeting and discussion for today. As a missionary from the Philippines, I would like to make this very brief statement that never in the history of the evangelical movement in the Philippines has the future of the Protestant Church been greater. The doors are wide open and men and women are coming in. I think that we need to evaluate that in terms of the religious background of the country. The Philippines, of course, being nominally a Christian land, has a little different approach than that of some of the other countries surrounding the Philippines, where there are many of the non-Christian faith. The Roman Catholic Church claims to have 85% of the population of the Philippines as their members. However, those that are critical of the Roman Church say that if they can claim 40%, they're claiming a large number. Now then, that presents the challenge which we as an evangelical Protestant church have in the Philippines. The difference between 40% and 85% is very great. And that means that this nominally Christian land, if it is not won for Christ, can become a secular state. And that would indeed be a tragedy. As we begin to discuss the Roman Catholic Church in the Philippines today, I think we need to begin with, first of all, a word of appreciation. I think that we need to be eternally grateful that the Roman Catholic Church did come to the Philippines and that they did bring Jesus Christ there. And I think that it is true in the Philippines, as it is true in other Roman Catholic countries, that the people of the land have a deep regard and respect for Christ. That is certainly true, and it makes our approach much easier. A respect for Christ, but a misgivings as far as the institution of the church is concerned. Therefore, I like to say that our work in the Philippines as missionaries is much easier than those in some of the surrounding countries. You see, the Roman Catholic Church brings men and women up to Good Friday. On Good Friday in the Philippines, the shows and eating places and stores are all closed. While on Easter morning, they even have a theater which is open for free movies for the children. Therefore, the Protestant Church in the Philippines has to only take men and women on a 3-day journey, really, from Good Friday to Easter Sunday. And that is a much shorter journey than to take them along the whole way of Christian understanding. I think we need to begin with a sense of appreciation for what the contribution that the Roman Catholic Church has made in the Philippines, but at the same time to evaluate the work of the church as a political institution. Perhaps my approach this morning is not necessary with you men who are engaged in historical research, but I have felt that perhaps we ought to lay something of a historical foundation for our discussion in order to arrive at some concrete conclusions. In order to refresh our memories, let us recall that it was on March the 6th in 1521 that Ferdinand Magellan landed on the shores of the Philippines. And let us also be mindful of the fact that with one hand he planted the Spanish sword and said, "In the name of my king, King Philip II, I name this land." And with the other hand, he planted the Christian cross and said, "In the name of the faith of my ruler, Philip II, I dedicate this land." And I think if we go into the history of it, we will see that Philip II accepted the challenge that had been given. For it is reported that when word came to him that the Philippines had been dedicated in his name, and that there was a likelihood that they would not be a very profitable possession, this statement is reported to have come from him. He says, "This is not a matter of the moment. I am an instrument of divine providence. The main thing is the conversion of the kingdom of Luzon, and God has predestined me for that end, having chosen me king for that purpose. And since he had entrusted so glorious a work to me and my crown, I shall hold the island of Luzon, even if by so doing I exhaust my treasury." In other words, you see, from the beginning, the Philippines was accepted by the Spanish government as being a missionary province. And if you will study the background of the government which they established in the Philippines, you will see that it was a government that was under ecclesiastical control, and that from the very beginning there was a constant struggle between the temporal authorities and the ecclesiastical authorities. I thought it might be interesting to point out some of the duties of an early parish priest in the Philippines. First of all, one of his duties was to assist in the selecting members of the municipal tribunal and to see to it that these officials were properly elected and then sign the certificate of election. In other words, he was right at the heart of the political system. And then he helped these officials choose and nominate the chief of the village. Third, he assisted in matters of taxation. And if you were to travel in the Philippines today, you would still see some of these ancient landmarks of the old church. All up through the provincial centers, churches that are far larger and far more, they just stand out as a sore thumb in the communities. If you were traveling with a critical Filipino, he might point out to those churches and say, "There's a symbol of Filipino slave labor." And if you go into the background, you will discover that that is exactly how many of those churches were built. They were required to give, in lieu of money, they were required to give so many days of labor, and the labor was intended for church architecture. That was one of the taxations that was imposed on them. And then he was the chief of the local census bureau, and all baptisms, marriages, and deaths were required to be filed by him. But the important thing for us to see is that the friar, his tenure of office was a permanent one. And once he had his parish, and once he was established in it, then he continued. He was a continuing factor. Whereas the temporal authorities, civil and military, they were shifted. In other words, he was really in control as far as the community was concerned. And any Filipino that crossed the path of the parish priest and created the antagonism of the priest toward him, it might result in his family being exiled. It might result in the loss of his family's lands. And the church was able to really keep very close control, and by that means were able to secure the loyalty of the people, if you want to call it loyalty. Now, it is strange, but the Roman Catholic Church has never had a very high estimate of the Filipinos. Here you have, in Asia, the only dominantly Roman Catholic country. And up to this point, they still do not have a Filipino cardinal. That's a very sore point. And there's a good deal of agitation going on now toward that end. Japan has got a cardinal, and yet Catholicism is a minority group there, but the Roman Church has never really fully trusted the Filipinos. You recall that after the occupation of the Philippines by the U.S. forces, that there were many hearings held with our American leaders as to determine what should happen to the Roman Catholic Church in the Philippines, as to what the American attitude should be. And the bishop, the Archbishop of Manila, Bishop Nozaleta, in testimony before this Philippine Commission, he reflects the attitude of the church toward Filipinos, or Indos as they were nicknamed. He says, the Filipinos had no proper individuality. They had an absolute want of character. They had just enough of the logical faculty to be rational beings. And they did not have enough sufficient mental capacity to digest any abstract questions. And their affection for their children is little more than that of an animal rather than that of a human. You can see in this testimony, which is a part of the United States record coming from the lips of this archbishop, that they did not have a very high regard for the Filipinos as Filipinos. Now the friars, or the institution of the Roman Catholic Church, were rightly or wrongly identified in the minds of the Filipinos with all the elements of misgovernment. And if you're going to understand the revolution of 1896, which preceded the revolution, preceded the American occupation of the Philippines, you've got to realize the hatred that was built up in the hearts and minds of Filipinos toward the Roman Church. Bonifacio, Aguinaldo, Del Pilar, Mabini, some of these outstanding leaders who took part in this revolution really were very incensed at the power of the Church over them. The beginning of the revolt against the Church didn't start in 1896, but it goes back to 1872. And in the tape recording, which we will hear a little later, taken from the Philippine Senate by Senator Roseller Lim, will point out the names of these three men. And he points them out as heroes of the faith. They were three Filipino priests that were killed by the Spanish government at the instigation of the Church. Jose Burgos, Mariano Gomez, and Jacinto Zamora. And these men became heroes in the eyes of Filipinos, and their death intensified the hatred of the Filipinos toward the Spanish friars. There's one point I think that we need to keep in mind, and that is that the revolt against the Church was not a revolt against Christ. General Aguinaldo, who was the general who led the revolt, taking over from Bonifacio, is still living. He's now past 90 years of age, and he's really quite a character. He's still very strong and very forceful. I heard him speaking not long ago to a group in which he said that the tyranny which they fought back in 1896 was again alive, and he feared was going to become the same threat that it had been in those days. General Aguinaldo, not being acquainted with theological terminology, being an army general, he had this statement to make. He says, the priest to whom object is made, and with whom we have mortal quarrel, are not our own priests, but the Spaniards and those are the orders. We respect the Catholic Church, and I think, knowing the general and his recent statements, what he would say here is that we respect the religion of Jesus Christ. He says, our war is not against the Catholic Church, but upon the friars, who have been the most cruel enemies, and we just simply cannot have them here. Now, this comes from the general who led the revolution. Therefore, the revolution was not directed against the Christian faith, but it was directed against the friar system that was tied in with the whole temporal affairs of the country. To bring it up to the present hour, there are a number of intelligent Filipinos, and the Philippines is blessed with a great number of very fine, outstanding leaders. If we had time this morning, we might talk about the great contributions of the public educational system that was established there in 1898 by our own government. One of the finest contributions were the contributions of those 3,000 American school teachers who went there to lay the foundations of a public educational system. These intelligent Filipinos are saying that they fear a resurgence of Roman Catholicism as much as they do of communism. For they say that in either case, their liberties and their freedoms will be taken from them. And then this same group of intellectuals are concerned at another point, and that is, they are greatly concerned that the young people now growing up in the Philippines have a sense of what they call a historical perspective, a deep sense of appreciation of the struggles of the past, and a deep sense of appreciation of the gains that were made at a very, very great cost. Some of you know a good deal about President Magsaysay. And in the American press and in the American mind, he was painted out as a very, very great hero. It may surprise you to hear me say this morning that President Magsaysay, dying as young as he did, died a great man. If he had lived very much longer, his reputation would have gone down. Now, he had a love for the common people and a concern for their welfare, and we all honor and respect him for that. I was privileged to go to his funeral service, which was held down in the open park in the Luneta, and it was like walking on holy ground that morning as thousands upon thousands were gathered there in deep mourning over the loss of their president. But Magsaysay wasn't as great a man as the American press painted him to be. And one of the things where he was the weakest was over this matter of religion. In order to be elected, and so overwhelmingly elected, he had sold out to the church. There is no question about it, but what he was a tool of the church. Now, he did not have a very strong intellectual background, and there were some of these leaders who were very dissatisfied with many of the things that he did that way, but there were a number of our Protestant leaders in the Philippines that were very greatly concerned because he lacked what they said was a historical perspective. He had no appreciation for these gains of the past, and he again had sold out to the church. I think that you ought to know that and to appreciate it, because it was one of the reasons why some of these intellectual leaders were concerned over the rapid resurgence of Roman Catholicism in the Philippines. I think you ought to also know that the Roman Catholic Church is doing everything that it can to plow the history of the past underground. This man, Dr. Jose Rizal, was really one of the great leaders of the Philippines. He's known as a great Malayan. He was a doctor, he was a writer, a philosopher. He was an outstanding man in any country. He was finally killed by the Spanish government at the instigation of the church, and he has left a great legacy to his people in his writings. He's got two novels, Reign of Greed and The Reign of Terror, which have been written by him. And strange enough, but in Indonesia, these books are on the required reading list because he's known as a great Malayan. But in the Philippines, it's banned reading as far as the Roman Catholic Church is concerned. And within the past 3 years, a bill was introduced in the Senate to make this required reading in the schools of the Philippines. Now you see, it's easy to take a national hero and put flowers on his monument and honor him. But it's another thing to have a respect for the contributions which he made. And if you go into these writings of Rizal, you'll find them not only interesting, but well written. And you will see why the Roman Church is opposed to having them get out into the minds of the young people. There's one chapter here on the friar and the Filipino. A Filipino student in argument with one of the friars. Fictional, of course, but it points up the problem. And then there's another paragraph here on the high official, pointing out that there were a number of Spanish government people that were very much concerned over things in the Philippines. But because of the control of the church over them, there was little they could do about it. Here's one of these enlightened Spanish leaders in his chapter on the high official, saying, "Ah, in your silence, I read their right to rebel. And if matters do not mend, they will rebel someday. And justice will be on their side. And with them will go the sympathy of all honest men, of every patriot in the world." And he goes on to argue against the ecclesiastical control. And then the end result is this official, government official, has to ask the question, "Do you know when the mail boat leaves?" inquired His Excellency coldly, when the high official had finished speaking. And 2 hours later, the high official handed in his resignation and announced his intention of returning to Spain by the next mail steamer. You can see these books are just filled with dynamite. And the Roman Catholic Church has aggressively said young Filipinos should not read this. And because one of the men who sponsored this bill was Senator Recto, and I have some material from him that I'd like to quote from a little later, he was later a presidential candidate. He was a president of the Constitutional Convention, an outstanding legalist, an outstanding politician. And because of his sponsoring that bill for the required reading of the books of the great Malayan, the Roman Catholic Church entered into a house-to-house campaign against him. And I've got some documents here to show you that too. In other words, the Catholic Church is very much concerned to keep this whole matter of a historical perspective under control. To show you how they've been able to do it, when this Senate bill was passed for the required reading of Rizal's books, the bill was to be implemented by the Secretary of Public Instruction. Now, the Secretary of Public Instruction is a Knight of Columbus and a Papal Knight, Manuel Lim. And what Manuel Lim has done, and I know him very well, he's very active in Rotary, and I know him quite well. What Manuel Lim has been doing has been to push it off. And although that bill passed about 3 years ago, it still has not been fully implemented in the Philippines. Isn't that tragic? Supposing we did that to Abraham Lincoln, it'd be the same thing. Now then, another interesting thing that some of these intellectuals are saying is that if the United States had not interfered in 1898, sometimes we think of ourselves as the great liberators. But as a matter of fact, General Aguinaldo and others had already beaten the Spaniards and had already set up a constitutional government at Malolos and had drawn up a constitution. And there are some of these intellectuals who say that if America had not come to the Philippines in 1898, the Filipinos would have taken care of the Roman Catholic Church once and for all, and it wouldn't be the threat and the problem that it is today. And there's something on their side. Now then, to come to the period of American occupation. During the American period, the principle of separation of church and state was adhered to. The matter of religious freedom was given, and it is at that point that our Protestant missions came for the first time to the Philippines. And in my mind and estimation, one of the greatest contributions of America to the Philippines was in the contribution of their public educational system. But it was on July 4th of 1946 that we finally granted to the Philippines their independence. And from this point on, we again see the Roman Catholic Church beginning to reassert itself as a state church. And they have gotten around to the point now through their Catholic Action and their Knight of Columbus organizations and the other groups which they have so vitally reorganized, that they are beginning to say that in order to be a true Filipino, you have to be a Roman Catholic. It's the same thing that they're saying in Pakistan, to be a true citizen of Pakistan, you belong to the Islam faith. It's the same pattern. The tide of nationalism tied with the Roman Church. Now the big transition has come at the point of the appointment of a papal nuncio. And to show you how this has worked out, because of the American position in the Philippines, in 1946, when they became a free independent nation, the American ambassador was dean of the diplomatic corps, which means that he was the one who, at state occasions and other affairs, was represented the rest of the diplomatic corps of the country. I had a wedding in Central Church. I married the ambassador to the Netherlands. And on the occasion of the wedding, the American ambassador, Myron Cowan, gave the bride away. And that was his place as a member of the diplomatic corps. He was acting officially. But 1 week after that wedding, Myron Cowan could no longer act in that capacity. In the meantime, a ship had come into the harbor. It was an American President Line ship, and on the mast staff, it carried the flag of a foreign country. It carried the flag of another nation, a small nation, but nation nevertheless. And the papal nuncio had arrived, and there was a great doing. And from that time on, the papal nuncio, according to the Geneva Agreement, becomes the dean of the diplomatic corps. And at all public receptions, the papal nuncio is there to show you how this worked out. Not that it hurts our American officials to take a back seat, but to show you the political side of the Roman Church. Soon after the papal nuncio arrived, there was a 4th of July celebration down on the Luneta. And the 4th of July is a day where there are hundreds of people come to the celebration. There's a speech for the president, there's usually a parade. And all the dignitaries sit up in a bandstand, a reviewing stand. Now, in the protocol, and protocol ranks very large, as you know, in State Department affairs, in diplomatic affairs, you have the president and the vice president and the Supreme Court justice, and you have all down the line in the front row. Now, the dean of the diplomatic corps sits on the front row, too. Now, before this foreign power came in, the papal nuncio arrived, the American ambassador would sit in that front row. But on the 4th of July of this occasion, and some of us took particular notice of this, the papal nuncio was on the front row and the American ambassador was back in the grandstand. Now, I'm only pointing that out because I think that we need to see two sides of the Roman Church. I have a very deep appreciation for sincere Catholics. And working in a Roman Catholic land, unless you have that sincere appreciation, you don't get very far. You begin with an appreciation of individual faith. But there's nothing that I despise more than the institution of the political church. And according to the Geneva Agreement, the ambassador, the papal nuncio is in charge of the diplomatic corps. I want to show you very quickly, and then we will go to the tape recording, how this has had many effects. This man who introduced the bill for the reading of the Reign of Greed was Senator Recto. He was the one who was the president of the Constitutional Convention and has been an outstanding leader in his country. I have a speech here by him, which some of you might like to read, in which he points out that when the Constitution of the Philippines was written, there was a clause of separation of church and state. But the clause was so written that he says it protects the church against the encroachment of the state. But they failed to put in another clause to prevent the encroachment of the church into the life of the state. And he says in this address, which I have here and which you're free to read, that the time has come when a new amendment must be made to the Constitution to protect it. In that regard, in the course of this address, he points out that in the election, and he points out in his own election, how the Roman Catholic Church is beginning to make religious tests, and how the Roman Church is beginning to assert its power. What was the cause of this sudden political belligerence on the part of the hierarchy? Why this recent unabashed attempt to dominate the state through the ballot box? No better answer can be given except that the hierarchy must have reached a decision to implement the policy announced in Rome in 1948, not exactly by the Vatican, but by the official organ of a powerful religious organization reputed to be advisor to popes, in which it says that when the Catholic Church is dominant, it will not tolerate other faiths. And the point that I'm trying to make this morning is you can see the politicians are very much concerned. I have another address here by an outstanding Baptist convert who now belongs to our work in Manila, given at the Central Philippines University, which is a great Baptist school at Iloilo. He's a one-man army against in the battle of the separation of church and state. He's the only Filipino member on the Board of Regents of the state university. And in this document, he points out how the Roman Church, in one way after another, including trying to take over the state university and making it a sectarian school, have been making their gains. And he again points up his concern. Dr. Gumersinda Garcia. I have here a clipping taken from the Manila Times paper on May 15th in this year. Archbishop Cuenco of Iloilo threatens to excommunicate Catholics who support the YMCA and study in Protestant schools. Archbishop Cuenco announced that effective May 31st, all YMCA supporters and all those who study in the Central Philippine University, that's a Baptist school, the Iloilo Mission Hospital, School of Nursing, and other Protestant schools are punished with excommunication. This excommunication, which is reserved for the ordinary, can be incurred both by the students who attend such schools and by their parents or guardians, he said. In other words, you see, the church is beginning to feel its power. Now, one of the very interesting younger senators is Senator Roseller Lim. He's a Roman Catholic. He is a graduate of the Presbyterian University, Silliman University at Dumaguete, and is a very outstanding young lawyer. He's come under the influence of the moral rearmament movement, and it has stimulated his thinking to some degree, but he still claims to be a Roman Catholic. And the tape recording which we have this morning is a tape recording of a privileged speech which he made in the Philippine Senate. He introduced a bill in the Senate for the nationalization of the heads of all schools in the Philippines. And coupled onto the bill was also a requirement that all teachers in the field of the social sciences and political sciences should also be Filipinos. Now, the bill was defeated. The rabid Romans got in there and they really battled things around, and they were able to defeat the bill, but it will be good for us to see the problem. Here is a paper in Manila that came out. Church expels Senator Lim because of this his activities here. May I just present a little from this tape so that you will understand a little more what it is about. He says, in spite of four centuries of Catholicism in our country, our religious priests and nuns are only assistants of foreigners in our own land. In our Catholic educational setup, our Filipino bishops and archbishops have very little, if any, control over our Catholic schools, colleges, and universities. The heads of the foreign religious orders are lording it over us. He says, this is the ninth wonder of the world. A sovereign Catholic nation and a captive Catholic education. It must be stopped now, in spite of the well-entrenched foreign domination by the unbending and equalizing force of law. We must be totally a sovereign nation. This is an appeal to our lawmakers, leaders, and every red-blooded Filipino to wipe out every vestige of inferiority complex, colonial mentality, and fear of the influence, wealth, and power of the foreign religious orders. It takes courage for a man now in a Catholic country to say this. Let's be appreciative of the courage that it does take. The friars especially, who in spite of the wealth they have acquired in their schools, colleges, and universities, would not be gracious enough to give the Filipinos, Indos they used to call us, an inch of concession, such as a headship of our institutions of learning. And then he points out later on how few priests there are. May I just read a few sections of this? How many orders and congregations for men established in the novitiates for Filipinos early enough in this country? In other words, how many seminaries are there here? And surprisingly enough, there are very, very few. And then he asks this question, how many Filipino religious priests and candidates are there in the various religious orders and congregations? There are only 187 Filipino religious priests, compared to 101,555 foreign religious priests. 187 Filipinos over against 1,555 foreign priests. Now that doesn't mean that they're teachers. The what?
How many seculars?
He doesn't give the seculars. But this has to do just with the ordained priests. I must not close without saying that while we have 20 Filipino bishops and 7 archbishops, they have no control at all over our 587 Catholic schools, colleges, and universities. They are controlled by foreign religious people. Finally, I say this. We have our independence now. We are a sovereign people. Our Filipino priests and religious women must be given positions of responsibility, and one of them is a headship of schools and universities. We are a sovereign Catholic nation with a captive educational system. And he goes through and gives a list of the best Catholic schools in the Philippines and points out who is at the head of them. This isn't just rabble-rousing. He's got the facts and the materials here. And in this speech that he gives in the Senate, he has to be sure of his ground because he is interrogated by the rabid Romans. I have with me, before I show you the tape, I have several books that might be good for you to have in your seminary libraries. Here is a doctoral thesis printed by the University of the Philippines Press in 1957, The Political and Constitutional Ideas of the Philippine Revolution. Some of you might like to look into it. And then this is another book written by a professor of history at the University of the Philippines, Revolt of the Masses, by Aconcilio. These two books are very, very recent, and I doubt whether you have them in your libraries here, but they will give you a good background in some of the things which I have been trying to say this morning. Before we turn to the tapes, there was a student convention held in the Philippines, and the students, the Protestant students, are very concerned over what is happening, and this is becoming one of the burning issues. And they made a list of 10 commandments as to how they might deal with this particular problem. May I just read them quickly? First, thou shalt get the facts, know your rights, fight on principles, ask questions. Pretty good, isn't it? Get the facts, know the rights, fight on principles, ask questions. Thou shalt not argue, lose your temper, make sweeping generalities, be just and anti, lose your sense of humor, and give in to the temptation to quit. Remember that every great movement started with a creative minority. And if the Protestant Church has any contribution to make to the Philippines, it's at this basis of being a creative minority, of making the Roman Catholic Church come into line and do the things that it ought to do. May we now present the tape recording, and maybe there will be room for questions at the end. The tape takes an hour and a quarter. It won't be necessary to listen to all of it. When you say quit, then we'll stop. And
can you say exactly what we're going to hear?
This is an address by Senator Roseller Lim in the Philippine Senate. And it was a privileged speech in defense of the bill that he introduced for the nationalization of the heads of all schools and colleges in the Philippines. And in this tape recording, he is attacked by the Roman Church, by the Roman Church leaders, some of the more rabid senators and other leaders. Well, all senators have, they can take several hours during each Senate session for expounding their pet theories. And this man took this privileged speech, and Filipinos do love to talk, but I think that's a custom even in our own U.S. Senate, isn't it, for senators to have a privileged hour when they can expound their theories. And that's what this is.
I wonder if some way you could gauge what are the most vital parts of this address so that you could play those for us, since our time obviously would not allow hearing the whole thing.
Well, why don't we take, say, 10, 15 minutes of it and then shut it off and then... Is that all right? I think we could
have more time than that, of course.
I will be very happy to try to answer any questions which you want to raise. I don't know if this is the time or...
The part where he's really at the heart of his thesis.
It goes all the way through. That's the point. He doesn't...
Is there any rebuttal on this?
Yes. You will run into some rebuttal.
Distinguished Senator from Zamboanga, Senator Lim, will make use of the privilege hour.
as announced by the Senate Majority Floor Leader, that is Senator Russell Lim, and the privilege of...
Mr. Senate President, gentle lady and gentlemen of the Senate. I'm glad I was able to come this afternoon and deliver this speech, because for the last 6 days I have been bedridden. But I consider this subject about which I'm going to speak this afternoon of so vital an importance that in spite of the fact that I am not fully recuperated, I have decided to come and deliver this speech. First of all, allow me to make some preliminaries. This speech is really mainly to defend bills on Filipinization of heads of schools, colleges, and universities in private schools. I refer to the House Bill 222, filed by Congressman Enverga, Chairman of the Committee on Education in the Lower House, and to my own Senate Bill number 38. Congressman Enverga's bill was filed on February the 3rd, 1958, and my bill was filed on February the 4th, 1958. You will notice that there is a great difference between the two bills. My bill is much more simple. It simply provides for the Filipinization of the heads of schools, colleges, and universities, and also that the subject on social sciences be taught by natural-born Filipinos. In the case of Enverga, I understand his bill, aside of this, also covers step by step, slowly. And then you know what is meant by the word spontaneous. Means out of their own volition, of their own accord, of their own will, of their own initiative. But I refuse to believe that these people are sincere, because they say let the Filipinization of heads of schools be gradual and spontaneous, when for centuries these heads of these Catholic schools, most of them are religious, members of foreign religious orders, have already been handling the headship of these schools, universities, and colleges, and until now they still say, give us time, let us make it gradual. They say, let's make it spontaneous, you better wait for the Catholic educational system to decide as to when we are going to give the headship of these schools and colleges and universities into the hands of Filipinos. How can it be spontaneous when they have been disobeying the orders of at least four popes? To be exact, since 1845. And in a general sense, they have even been disobeying since 1622, almost four centuries, the universal policy of Rome, of the Vatican, namely, to give positions of responsibility to our native clergy. When are we going to wait? How much longer are we going to wait for this foreign religious order to give the headship of these schools to Filipinos? I presume if they would ever give it to Filipinos, they would give it first to the Filipino Catholic priest. I hope so. Because our history has shown us that these foreign religious orders do not seem to have any respect for our Filipino priest. And in spite of the fact that Fathers Burgos, Governor Zamora were garroted only a stone's throw away from Congress, right from where I am speaking, 86 years ago, until now, this foreign religious order has been disobeying four popes, Pope Leo XIII, Benedict XV, Pope Pius XI, and our present Pope, Pope Pius XII. They have been disobeying not only these four popes, their encyclicals, and two papal letters. They have been disobeying the Council of Trent of 1545. They have been disobeying the directives of the Sacred Congregation of the Propaganda Fide. That is an office which takes care of foreign missions from the Vatican. My friends, I'm afraid that I will have to go deeper into this question of schools. Because by going deeper, I will go into the cause. Because this refusal of the religious foreign religious orders, to give the headship of the Catholic schools to Filipinos, is the effect only of this cause. And now let me go into the cause. And I do say, I would like to begin by concluding that the cause is the constant refusal of the foreign religious orders to let go of this Catholic school in spite of the orders of the Pope. Pope Leo XIII says in his Quae Mare Cynico, that is matters pertaining China, but that was particularly applicable to the Philippines. I'm quoting from sources, from ecclesiastical sources, gentlemen of the Senate. Leo the person in it, Quae Mare Cynico says, quoniam experiendo plane compertum est, clerum indigenam per utilem ubique esse, curem diligenter episcopi, ut indigenarum sacerdotum numerus augere valiat. Says that the bishop, and he says that at the time when there was no Filipino bishop yet, but foreign bishop, that since the native clergy has been proven to be useful because they understand the people, the bishop must see to it that the native clergy must grow in number. Augere valiat. And then he continues to say, Pope Leo XIII, quos vero usus et experientia prestantiores ostendirent eos ad posiores procurationes gradatim ad vocem, that these native clergy, when practice has shown that they have become proficient, they must be given positions of responsibility. But in all these centuries, I will show you later, my friends, our Filipino clergy has been nothing but muchachos, assistants of the foreign religious orders in this country. I'm going to show you later with fucking evidence. I'd like to say now momentarily, however, because I can no longer contain myself, that of the 34 religious orders of Catholicism that we have in this country, not one is headed by Filipino priests. All these 34, I'm going to read to you their names and the heads, respectively, are headed by either Canadian, American, Irish, Belgian, Dutch, French, Spaniards, of course. Not a single Filipino has any one of these 34 Catholic religious orders in the Philippines. That is for men. And for women, of the 35 religious orders, only 5 are in the hands of Filipinas. And that is so because in these 5 orders, only Filipinas are allowed to become members. But in cases, when let us say, for example, the hospital in St. Paul's in Iloilo, there are 30 sisters in that hospital, 29 are Filipinas, 1 is French. The French is the superior. The sisters are the muchachas. They are the assistants. In spite of the fact, my colleagues in the Senate, that Benedict the 15th and Pope Pius XI and Pope Pius XII, particularly Pope Pius XII, say that these foreign missionaries, must move in hastening steps from place to place daily, up to the last unknown roof, up to the last unknown person. When this Pope Pius XII says, I quote him again, citariore gradu profere quotidie, move in hastening steps daily, ex alis ad alias flagas, from place to place, usque ad ultimum ignotumque sectum, up to the last unknown roof, usque ad ultimum ignotumque hominem, until the last person. But look at these Dominicans and Franciscans here. They have been here for almost 4 centuries, squatting, amassing wealth in our Catholic schools, such as the Santo Tomas and the Letran. And I'm going to prove with evidence and facts later on from ecclesiastical sources. How long are we going to bear with patience this foreign religious order? Perhaps after I deliver this speech, when this speech reaches home, perhaps for the good of my own Catholic faith, this anomaly, this cancer, for which Father Burgos Gomez Zamora was garroted, because they fought for the Filipinization of the clergy of the Philippines. Perhaps my church will become stronger, because right now in the Philippines, I'm afraid for my church. Many non-Catholic sects are already gaining ground, even the Iglesia ni Cristo is gaining ground, because of anomalies such as this, which I believe for the first time is being denounced. This may be my political suicide, but I don't care. I do believe that the Filipino clergy must be protected, and that the death of Father Burgos Gomez Zamora 86 years ago shall not remain forever as in vain. Ristar himself, in his Noli Me Tangere in Filibusterismo, he dedicated the Filibusterismo, the second volume of his two novels, to Gomburza. He says something like this about Burgos Gomez Zamora, if I can still remember or recall, when we were discussing the Noli Philip Bill here. Seems to me I recited from memory the preface of the Filibusterismo, and it ran something like this. Rizal said, addressing his preface to the memory of those three Filipino proto-martyrs who fought for the Filipinization of the clergy 86 years ago, and nothing has been done until now. He said, la religión al negarse a degradaros ha puesto en duda el crimen que se os ha imputado. El gobierno arrodillar vuestra causa de misterio y sombras hace creer que un error ha sido cometido en momentos fatales. Y el Filipinas entera, al venerar vuestra memoria y llamaros mártires, no reconoce de ninguna manera vuestra culpabilidad. En tanto pues, mientras no se demuestre claramente vuestra participación en la algarada caviteña, hayáis o no, hayáis sido o no patriotas, hayáis abrogado o no sentimientos por la libertad, sentimientos por la justicia, es mi deber dedicar mi trabajo a vosotros como a víctimas del mal que trato de combatir. Y mientras esperamos que España os rehabilite un día y no se haga solidaria de vuestra muerte, sirvan estas páginas, referring to the pages of filibusterismo, como tardía corona de hojas secas sobre vuestras ignoradas tumbas, y todo aquel que sin pruebas evidentes ataque vuestra memoria, que en vuestra sangre se manche las manos. Are we going to let the death of Father Burgos Gomez Zamora remain in vain as it has remained for the last 86 years? It is only in this country will we allow the foreign religious orders to control our native clergy. We are already an independent nation. The conquistadores are done. McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders are already done. We are now independent. We are Filipinos in our judiciary, in our legislature, in our in Malacañang and elsewhere. And yet, this same control by religious foreign religious orders, is still continue up to the present time without any sign at all of disappearing, in spite of the papal order to keep moving from with hastening steps from day to day until the last group, unknown group, is reached, and until the last unknown person. And aside of this, Pope Pius XII also ordered the foreign missionaries who have been squatting for centuries since the time of the conquistadores in 1565 to be attacked when they came with the Caspi. He told them that the foreign...
Perhaps you would prefer to have this lecture continue, and we're going to leave it to you as to which you consider most profitable. Whether you would like to take some time now for the discussion, we have approximately 20 minutes that we can use for questions and discussion of this very fine presentation that Dr. Mosbrook has given us. Or if you choose, we can continue to listen to the tape. If you have some wish to express in the matter. Certainly,
While you are deciding which you'd like to do, it is in order for us to express in this way our very sincere appreciation to Dr. Mosbrook for his lecture this morning. It has been not only startling, but informative. And I think all of us will recognize that there is something for us to take to heart and to realize that it is still true that eternal vigilance is the price of our liberties, even our religious liberties. And if we'll take that as by common consent of the assembly, we'll ask the secretary to enter a word of appreciation on the minute to our lecturer this morning. Now, what is your will concerning the time at our disposal? That is one expression. Are you all in concurrence with that? I think that is quite the unanimous consent of the assembly. And unless there is someone who objects to that, we would simply by common consent take that as the leading of the assembly, and we'll go immediately to a period of questions and discussion. I think we'll ask Dr. Mosbrook to come up here and be available for your questions, if you have such, or for any other. I'm not sure that I get the right angle here. I hope it'll work at any rate. Dr. Scherer?
Well, I noticed from your newspaper headline that the Jesuits defended from this point of view and supported Senator Lim. What was the Jesuit position and what has been the outcome?
Well, he had just been elected to the Senate, so he had 6 years to run. He still had 5 years of his term, and he hoped that he would be able to win his way back into the graces of the people. But as he points out, it was political suicide for him to do this, and he still is up. This speech by Senator Recto, in which he tells Hillier, he says, "I am pledged to this crusade." He's talking about the separation church and state. He says, "It may end in another personal disaster." See, and he was already a political victim, but that is a lot of most crusaders. And I think it's really wonderful that you have these men in these high places that are taking the stand that they are. And we Protestants have a great opportunity just not to engage in the fight, but to let these men know that we're behind them. And it becomes a rabid Roman Catholic against a Roman Catholic with eyes open, and there's a difference. And this man's got his eyes open.
That's right. The
well, they're opposed to it. They have fought it all on the line. The Franciscans, the Dominicans, and the Jesuits, all three orders.
But didn't
the
headline say that the Jesuits are supporting him? That's the thing I'm asking
about. No, this. It says Jesuit. Oh, I see what you mean. They didn't finally back him. And Dr. Beaver was pointing out in the Christian Century of this week in the Philippine section, there were one of the Jesuit priests had been in trouble because of his defense of, and so as a group, they were opposed. I didn't get your point.
No, this is
well, they did not support it there, finally. I mean, they were as opposed to it as any of the rest. Yes. Well, yes, I think he would say he was. But you know what he'd say? So what? The excommunication doesn't mean very much. I happen to belong to the Masonic Order, and in the Philippines they're very strong. They preceded our Protestant work there, as you know, and were really the backbone of the revolution. But I belong to a lodge in Manila where the men of the lodge have committed their bodies in a will to the burial of the lodge. You know why? In other words, when they die, the lodge takes over the funeral, for the reason that the Roman Church has excommunicated the men because they belong to the sacred order. It has held a hold of the families. And now what happens at death is that the church moves in and says, for so much money, we'll bury him as a loyal son of the church. It's a financial drain on the families in the first place. And in the second place, it violates some of the principles that these men stood for, this independence that they have. And so, actually, in this lodge in Manila that I belong to as a member, the Filipino members have made out wills committing their bodies to the lodge for burial. And that's the reason for it. It isn't that they want a lodge burial. It isn't that they want to take it away from the families, but they're just taking it out of the clutches of the church.
Is there any remnant close to the lodge and church? Or are they doing it entirely outside of the clutches?
That's where I think we need to see the importance of this whole struggle. You see, you have a very small, loyal, rabid group who have come under the influence of the Knights of Columbus and the Catholic Action and the intensified efforts which they're making. But you've got a large group of men, such as Senator Lim is one, Senator Recto is another, who still say they're Roman Catholic. But you noticed in Senator Lim's speech, he says, I'm not a very good Roman Catholic. He's been flirting around with the moral rearmament movement, and it's had quite an influence on him. He's introduced several other bills where you can see the impact of that particular group in his thinking. And there's this large group in the Philippines who still, their families are inside the church, but they themselves are outside the church. I'm thinking now about the men. And the field is just wide open, because they're in a nebulous state. They've got a religious background, but they've broken from the old past. And it's very important what we as an evangelical church do in the Philippines in the next decade or two. Does that explain your question? There was a question here.
I'm going to ask if Carlos Romulo had come out and made a definite stand on this issue, and also Senator Camilo
Osillas. Well, now, Camilo Osillas, of course, is very active in the Masons, and he was all for this. But now Carlos Romulo is one of the rabid men. When President Garcia came to the United States, there were some of us in the Philippines that had gotten busy, and we got him an honorary degree. I was one of the men. We got him an honorary degree from Temple University, thinking that, well, when he came here, what a fine thing it would be if a Protestant institution would give him an honorary degree, recognize him, and let him see that Protestants were aware of his work in the Philippines. Well, I was very embarrassed over the matter, because I was one of the men that had signed the telegrams and had gotten the word off. And it got into the office of the president. And the office of the president, in his visit here, everything had been turned over to Carlos Romulo in the United States. And you know, we never even got a decent reply from that man. He's as rabid as he can be. Now, he's an outstanding fellow and I recognize his greatness, and he's an outstanding speaker. But on this religious issue, he's got a bias which runs very, very deep. I've been in several conferences. There was a Baguio conference held where they had leaders from all the countries of Southeast Asia. And at that conference, there were several things which came out which is evidence of his religious convictions, not too tolerant.
You make no reference to the independent Catholic Church. How does that tie in with all this?
Well, Bishop Aglipay was a Roman Catholic priest and broke off from the Roman Church, and he started this independent Philippine Catholic Church. They have had that. Let's go back just a bit. The intelligent Filipinos say that if it hadn't been for the American intervention, the Philippine Independent Catholic Church would have really become strong, because these priests, when they broke off from the church, they occupied church property. And they set themselves up in business in a pretty good way. But the first thing American Justice did was to make them get out of the churches and turn the churches back to the Romans. And so, but the movement, as it has gone across the years, has not been too successful. First of all, they got into some internal trouble. And then second place, the training of their clergy was one of their weakest points. Now, the Episcopal Church at this point has done one of the most statesmanlike things that has been done in the Philippines since the war. When Bishop Aglipay broke off from the church, he did not take with him the apostolic succession. The Episcopal Church brought out about five or six bishops from America here, and they made a big occasion out of it in the Philippines, and they passed on the apostolic succession to the Aglipayan priest. In other words, put them back into the tradition. Now, they had been going off into Unitarianism and in some other ways, and they brought them back into the Christian stream. Then the second thing that they did, the Episcopal Church, of course, came to the Philippines with a policy that they would not proselyte among Roman Catholics. Most of the strength of the Episcopal work in the Philippines has been with the non-Christian groups up in the mountain areas, among the Igorots and other groups up there. They've done a wonderful work. But they have never had a strong work that would encourage Roman Catholics to come in and join them. Their cathedral in Manila was pretty largely for the American and the foreign community. Now, since the war, they have opened, the Episcopal Church has opened in the city of Manila, a St. Andrew's Seminary. And the St. Andrew's Seminary is primarily for the training of Aglipayan priests. They have, there's about 30 men, I believe, enrolled. And in the seminary, it's not too large, it's just in the beginning, but about 25 of those 30 men will be Aglipayan priests. And the Bishop Delos Reyes, the present head of the church, he's beginning to consolidate the group. They've now feel a sense of they're back in close cooperation with in close following of the Christian tradition. He's very cooperative with our other Protestant groups in Manila and throughout the Philippines, as a matter of fact. And this training for the priest is going to give their church a status. And of course, their church ought to grow. They count about 2 million members. So what the Episcopal Church has done with their group, without enticing them to enter into an organic union, if they, the Episcopal Church has suggested to Bishop Delos Reyes, you come and join fellowship with us, they would have scampered away like frightened rabbits. But as it is, the Episcopal Church has said, we want to do everything we can to bring status to your church, and so they've started this training program. It's been wonderful, really. I'm very appreciative of what's been done.
There was a very baffling aspect about all this. Why in the Philippines, of all places, do you have resistance to the papal policy and that of the propaganda? The most insistent in the overall Roman strategy under the last four popes has been to meet the challenge and pressures of nationalism by speeding up the recruiting and training of an adequate indigenous clergy and establishing national hierarchies, which were a the fulfillment of national desires, and which to a certain extent then was the Muslim pressure. But here in the Philippines, we have the very opposite. We have the orders all opposed to this, and even the Jesuits now have dismissed a priest from their order for leaving and a movement for the reorganization of the clergy. And does this all mean, too, that in the Philippines, the priests are all in religious orders? Are there any large bodies of secular priests under the bishops outside of orders? And what's the secret there are?
Well, now, if you paid attention to this speech by Rosella Lim, he appeals to the encyclicals of the Pope, saying the same thing you did. He puts it on a historical basis. The statement has been made, and I think it can be proven, that there are more evangelical rural ministers in the Philippines than there are than there are Roman Catholic priests. The priests stay to the center, but the main centers have been held in control of the foreign priests, and the Senator Lim, in a speech that I heard him make after this Senate presentation, he claims that much of his information has come from four Filipino Jesuits, and he claims that as a hierarchy has found out where he was getting his information, that they've taken those four young men and they have scattered him. In other words, they have made them ineffectual by scattering them and not allowing them to be close together where they could feed this material. Now, they haven't gained their purpose. They just created resentment against them. But you have pointed up the point, Dr. Beaver, and why is it? Now, here you have a dominantly Roman Catholic country, and they've never given the Philippines a cardinal. I was interested in Laterat in reading this week. He says, on this very point, because of the character of its structure, the Roman Catholic Church could not give full independence to churches fostered by its missions. In every land and among every people, that church was kept under the direction of Rome. The Pope surrendered none of his powers, and the supervision of the entire church was still by the papal curia. That was Laterat to say. But I can't answer some of these questions. They really are very difficult. The thing that's very interesting is that there now is a papal ambassador. There's an ambassador to the Vatican from the Philippines. But you know, the interesting thing is that there is also an ambassador to Italy who is resident in Rome. And the ambassador to Italy is a Protestant, Judge Regala. he resides in Rome, and he's the official ambassador to the country. But the ambassador, they now have an ambassador to the Vatican. And then here's another interesting thing. The ambassador to the Vatican is Dr. Delgado. His cousin, former Senator Francisco Delgado, is a 33rd degree Mason, very high in the Masonic work, and is very active in the Masonic work, very liberal in thought. And he is now the ambassador to the United Nations. In other words, here you have from the same family two men, one very, very rabid, and the other very, very liberal.
On this matter of the nationalization of the churches by the Roman Catholics, isn't the real test whether they have loyal members of the leadership who are national so that they can trust them, then they will move along. If they cannot, and have these people play directly under the Roman hierarchy, then they will not give any nationalism any real status.
Well, I think what you're saying there, they've been at it, Rosella Lim says, they've been at it all this time, and they still haven't been arrived at that. What I've been saying to some of the groups I've been speaking to here in America is that one of the contributions which Protestantism has to make to the Philippines is for us to be a creative minority. And one of the evidences of our creativity is that we haven't been there for four centuries, but there is not a single institution that I know of in the Philippines now that is in hands of missionaries. The Philippine Federation of Christian Churches, Jose Yap, Diliman University, President Ruiz, you can go down the line. In other words, the Protestant Church has developed a group of very, very strong and very outstanding leaders. And the argument there would be the same, that we can keep anybody under control by keeping them ignorant. And that's what Rosella Lim, I'm sure, would say, that the Catholic Church has had time to prepare leaders, and the fact that he points out the few seminaries that are engaged in this business and how weak they are in comparison to the great need. But they haven't tried very hard. Does that answer your question?
That's fine. There's one more question back here. I don't know your name. And I think this will have to be the last before our business session.
It was a question that I felt that some of these questions are already been answered, why they're not being more to in addition. I used your earlier statement about the most book that they have such a low respect for the fellow people.
Yeah.
They scarcely consider him human. And naturally, they would not do the same in the Philippines as they would in some other foreign countries where they have a higher respect for the national. Isn't that some of the answer?
That plus the fact that they don't trust him, because the Filipino is very independent. He's you can't control him.
They quote it by saying that he is of such a low character and low mentality, and he's incapable. But it's the typical Roman way of caring for a problem by putting their own interpretation.
It must be very difficult to answer the Catholicism.
Oh, no, this is Spanish.
It's more universal than we think.
Yeah. Well, Americans and French, they're from, I'll show you, you look at this book and you can get, well, I'm convinced of this, and this is the close, that what they cannot control, they will destroy.
Thank you very much.